It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. Executives at major retailers like Walmart, like Walgreens and Target, are voicing concerns about the escalation of retail theft, estimated by the industry's largest trade association as a nearly $100 billion problem. Call in with your questions about retail theft. Share your experiences working at a Wisconsin store, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Adrian Beck is an emeritus professor in the Department of Criminology at the University of Leicester in the United Kingdom. He's an advisor to a Belgian firm that researches retail theft. Adrian, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, good morning. Yes, it's great to be with you.
Good morning. Well, let's start our conversation hearing from the biggest retailer in the world. Walmart CEO Doug McMillon recently told CNBC about his concerns regarding retail theft.
Theft is an issue. It's higher than what it's historically been. And we've got safety measures, security measures that we put in place by store location. I think local law enforcement being staffed and being a good partner is part of that equation. And that's normally how we approach it.
Okay, so what do you hear in McMillon's analysis of the problem?
Well, obviously, you know, retail theft is not a new issue. It's been around ever since, you know, stores were first opened, people coming in and trying to get product for free. So it's not new. It's a question of whether it's getting worse or not. And, you know, we've heard it from a number of retailers that they think that the problem is getting worse more recently. And part of that could be related to, you know, the fact that we are going through, in many countries, a cost of living crisis. You know, things are really tough for a lot of families out there. And that could, in some respect, be driving people towards being more likely to steal from stores. But it can be difficult for retailers to fully understand what amount of their loss is actually due to external theft versus, for instance, internal theft, or indeed just mistakes they make within their own organization. So it's often not as clear cut, perhaps, as, you know, some people might think.
Something else I hear in McMillon's words there is leaning into police to be a partner with Walmart in, leading to an arrest, something on your record. Should shoplifting be criminalized and prosecuted? Does that deter retail theft?
Well, it's already criminalized, of course. You know, it has been for an awful long time. I mean, to steal things is a crime. And if we, you know, often we use very strange language around this, don't we? We call it shoplifting often, which is a very strange term for basically stealing things. So it has been a criminal offense for a long time. I think the issue for some people is that in certain states in America, for instance, the amount that you steal can have an impact upon whether you're prosecuted or not. There are some of these limits. So, for instance, if it's below a certain amount, then you're not likely to get prosecuted. And that's a concern to some retailers. So, you know, it is a crime. The question, of course, is to what extent is it a police priority to deal with this? You know, there is an argument by some people, of course, that, you know, that retailers have to take more responsibility. After all, they are, you know, often, you know, can be argued that they're making it very easy for people to steal from their stores. And so perhaps they have to take some responsibility for the way that they are marketing and displaying and protecting their own products. A bit like there's an expectation that you'll protect your own house, isn't there? That you'll lock the doors and windows and, you know, and perhaps employ security. So, you know, I think there's a degree to which the police will say, is this a priority for us? And if it is, to what extent are the people that we're protecting taking responsibility for something that may be partly due to the way that they're operating their businesses?
What about the transition and the change to self-checkout? The overwhelming number of self-checkouts now, is the expanded use of them at brick-and-mortar stores perhaps a cause for more retail theft?
Yeah, I think there's certainly growing evidence around this now. I mean, I've carried out studies over 10 years now around self-checkout. And, you know, there's no question that I think self-checkout leads to more retail loss. You know, I think for two reasons. One, you know, you are providing more opportunities for people to potentially abuse these systems. And secondly, you're also expecting a lot from customers, which is, you know, we're now expecting you to scan all these things accurately, despite not providing you with any training. You know, I think there's two elements to this. One is losses which are driven by self-checkout through error, people just making mistakes. And secondly, they undoubtedly do make it easier for some people to decide to take product without paying for them. So I think they certainly, in certain parts of retail, particularly in grocery, where it's most used, then there's no question, I think, that there's a link between growing losses and the use of self-checkout.
But you're also using less workforce, less people working checkout lanes. Does that balance out at all?
Well, that's right. Yes, I mean this is a, you know, a cost versus expenditure, an income, you know, question that retailers have, which is that there's no question that the main reason why retailers introduce self-checkout is they want to save labor costs. There's no other, you know, that's the main driver for why retailers brought this in the first place. And so we have seen in grocery in particular, then they can make dramatic savings. So it's just a question of balancing it out, is do you save more from the labor that you know, expenditure compared with the extra amount you're losing through malicious and non-malicious loss. And that's an equation that retailers have to play out within their own organizations. But I think what we're finding is that over time, the amount of loss is growing with self-checkout. And so that equation needs to be reevaluated on a regular basis by retailers, I think.
Talking about retail theft with Emeritus Professor Adrian Beck, works in criminology at the University of Leicester in the United Kingdom. You can join in along the way, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a call. Steve in Sun Prairie. Hi, Steve. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just want to make sure I'm hearing the guest correctly, and maybe I'm mishearing it, but it sounds like victim blaming here, that the store is responsible in any way for someone coming in and stealing their product. And then the solution is, let's take private security to be able to, I guess, what, strong arm customers or who maybe not be trained correctly. Is that what I'm hearing part of the solution is, that the recommendation is of your guest?
Steve, thanks. Adrian.
Well, you know, I think retailers are not blameless. I'm not blaming for everything, obviously, but I mean, you know, if you developed a business model whereby you make it incredibly easy for people to come in and potentially steal from them, then you have a degree of responsibility to make sure that you're taking some responsibility for that protection and not simply going back onto the public purse and saying, I expect the police now to protect my model of selling, where I want to make all the profit, but not pay for any of the consequences of that model. So I think we, you know, retailers have to take some responsibility for the way that they design and the business decisions they've made, which they're doing obviously to make a profit. And so they have to, you know, evaluate that as part of their business model. And then in terms of strong arming, well, you know, it's obviously customers have a choice about which shops they shop in. And if, you know, if they can obviously vote with their feet. If they don't like retailers that are exclusively self-checkout, then they can decide to go elsewhere, I suppose. But so I'm not sure I fully understand the strong-arming element of the argument, Steve, that you're making.
Can you go and talk a little bit further about the effects of inflation? I mean, this correlation between record high 40-year inflation that not only the U.S., but the world is feeling, and what that relationship is like with retail theft.
Yeah, I think it's not inflation per se. It's the impact of inflation on the cost of living, I think, that we need to fully understand here. And over the years, you know, we've seen a number of economic cycles, haven't we? From, you know, we can chart them back to the 1950s. And people have tried to make a relationship between economic cycles and levels of crime. And it's proven really quite difficult to do, partly because there's been a lack of data. It's very hard to measure some of these things accurately to understand whether there's a correlation between the economy and crime. But what we are seeing, I think, which is, you know, this is the highest inflation we've probably seen in 30 or 40 years in some countries. It's not something we've really had to think about for an awful long time. And now we are, and we've seen prices rising dramatically. And, you know, I think inevitably that impact on the cost of living is profound. And there's certainly a proportion of society that are undoubtedly now struggling. I mean, in the UK, we call them the precariat. They're the people living in a very precarious situation where they're often living, you know, from day to day and paycheck to paycheck. And that can put tremendous pressure on those families. And sometimes they can be driven to, you know, perhaps committing crime that they probably wouldn't have done, but are, you know, really doing it out of desperation. And so we're seeing this around grocery in particular, where, you know, people are perhaps being driven to steal because of the pressure from the cost of living and, you know, driven by inflation that is, you know, putting them in a situation where probably they wouldn't want to be, but it could be a state of desperation. And so, you know, my argument and my point to retailers have been that, you know, this is really quite a difficult time for a lot of people, and they need to be aware of this in terms of how they think about protecting their stores, but also understanding the impact it's having on certain parts of populations.
Do you know whether retailers pass on the costs of this theft, this shrinkage? Does that come into what the customers pay on for these products?
Inevitably. I mean, somebody has to pay the price, and that will be reflected basically in the, you know, in the costs that retailers charge their consumers, which is it's factored into, you know, the margin that they need to sell those products in their stores. And so, you know, the ultimate people who pay for loss are the customers themselves, because it is reflected in the prices that retailers have to charge in order to cover their costs and make a profit.
Adrian Beck with us, advisor to the ECR Retail Loss Group, founded the Department of Criminology at the University of Leicester. Call in with your questions about shoplifting. Share what you've noticed at Wisconsin businesses, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn why retailers lock up items like cologne and baby formula, teeth whitening strips, and other efforts to prevent shoplifting that company executives say is on the rise. Call in with your questions about retail crime, what you notice as a shopper or as a store employee. Join in the discussion, 800-642-1234. Adrian Beck is an emeritus professor of criminology at the University of Leicester and stays with us. Let's bring on another call. Amy is here from Galesville. Amy, what would you like to bring up?
Good morning. I agree with the previous caller, and I'm finding just the framing of this conversation problematic. If you were to put it from the point of a mom and pop shop, I think we could have more sympathy, but Walmart, people stealing from Walmart, they're doing fine. Their profits are fine. Their CEO is fine. So if people are stealing food, that's a problem that we need to deal with in this country in other ways, not by beefing up security so people can't eat on a regular basis. So I think part of what I'd like to know then is, do we have numbers or, you know, information on what is being stolen?
Amy, thank you. Adrian, numbers on what is being stolen?
It's very difficult to get these numbers. You know, and so, you know, when I've looked at certainly in self-checkout, what you find is it's broad range of products tend to get non-scanned or mis-scanned by customers. It covers a whole gamut of different types of things, which often suggests it's more error than theft, actually. But retailers, you know, lose, you know, you mentioned at the beginning, they claim it's $100 billion a year. It's very difficult to know of that $100 billion a year, what proportion is due to theft internally or externally, or indeed due to errors that the organization has made themselves. They're not very good at actually being able to understand what elements of their loss is due to any particular cause. And so, you know, to Amy's point, you know, it'd be a whole raft of things depending on the type of retailer and what they're selling. And you know, we are living through a very difficult cost of living crisis. And I've spoken to some retailers who are hugely sympathetic to some of the people that they're catching who are stealing, who, you know, are in very vulnerable situations and, you know, very desperate situations. It's a very difficult situation for all concerned, isn't it, in terms of do you simply then just condone people who want to steal through need, or how do you then define what is need? Is it relative need, absolute need? And that can be a very difficult decision for communities and indeed retailers to begin to decide what to do about this issue.
You've also studied retail theft about looking at security camera technology and what has changed there. What do you notice with security cameras?
Yeah, there's been a huge investment in retail around, you know, whole swathes of ways in which they try and stop people or stop losses happening within their organizations, you know, including things like technologies, as you mentioned, like video, but also tagging and so on. And there's been a huge expansion in the use of video technologies, and particularly due to, you know, developments around what is known as digital technologies, which means you can digitize images and therefore do a lot more with it. And so you'll see, I think, increasingly a lot of retail stores in America, but in other countries as well, a growing use of video for a number of different reasons. Some of it is very passive, it's simply just watching, but others are becoming more active. So, for instance, if people are using self-checkout, these technologies can increasingly begin to try and identify when perhaps you haven't scanned an item by accident or on purpose, and the system can begin to identify that behavior, and either it can either bring it to the attention of a member of staff, or in some circumstances, the system can say to the shopper, hey, you know what? It looks like you didn't scan that last item. Do you want to have another go? And so there's this sort of growth of what are known as video analytics, trying to begin to identify behaviors that can either be corrected or brought to the attention of people who might want you to not do that behavior.
Last year, Home Depot started allowing stores to disable power tools using Bluetooth technology until that they're purchased. Does Bluetooth locking prevent theft? What do you see there?
Well, the technology there is really about, it's about basically using something. It can be Bluetooth, but other technologies available, which basically makes it a dumb device until there's some sort of code which is entered to say this product will now work. So it only works on obviously electronic objects. And so it's a bit like, you know, the phone won't work unless you can prove you've paid for it. So it's really, you know, it's basically what we call benefit denial. In other words, there's no point in stealing it because it won't work until you paid for it. And so it's just another form of crime prevention, which is basically making it a dumb brick unless you can prove you've paid for it. So it's an interesting technology, but it requires a lot of infrastructure in place, a lot of work with the manufacturers to make sure that they've embedded this sort of system within to their electronics of any given product. But it's certainly an interesting development around, you know, simply taking away the point of stealing something if it doesn't work.
Talking about retail theft with expert Adrian Beck from the University of Leicester, let's go to Joe in Lake Halley. Joe, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Joe. Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
All right, go ahead.
I had a couple of points. I've read some articles that have attorneys basically recommending not using self-checkout because there's been a number of people that were, you know, basically innocent of, or not intending to steal anything, or even falsely accused of stealing stuff. And as a side note, I've noted, at least at like our local Walmart, that oftentimes there's actually less of a line at the old-fashioned checkouts.
Joe, thank you for the call. Joe, and I know it was a little bit hard to hear, but attorneys telling people not to use self-checkouts because they've seen people falsely accused, Adrian.
Yes, I've heard this a number of occasions now in America. I haven't seen any cases in any other country in terms of people being falsely accused. I think what the typical situation I find is that retailers really struggle to make any form of prosecution because it can be very difficult to prove intent. You know, if I have scanned five items and don't scan one item, the retailer's really got to show that I didn't mean to do that, particularly when they've made me use that technology. So, you know, I've heard these stories of, you know, the threat of being prosecuted by SCR, but from my work in SCR over the many, many years, I haven't seen very many cases of this at all. In fact, it's much more the other way, really, which is, it's, you know, retailers shy away from trying to prosecute because it can be incredibly difficult to get, you know, pretty strong evidence to say that the intent was there to do it. And then in terms of speed, absolutely. I mean, all the research shows that people using self-checkout think they're faster than somebody at a checkout, a trained member of staff, and they're definitely not. But it's that perception, isn't it, of actually doing it. You feel like you're doing something when you're at a self-checkout, so you think you're being quicker. But a trained member of staff can scan far more items than most people can do because they simply don't do it very often, whereas trained staff are doing it all the time. So it can be. You know, you think you're saving time, but you're not. But, a lot of retailers increasingly are pushing customers to the point where there's really no option but to use self-checkout. And that can cause a lot of frustration, a lot of anxiety and a lot of angst and issues for members of staff as well who have responsibility for looking after these machines. You know, I did a recent survey of 6,000 members of staff who work at self-checkout looking after these machines. And there were worrying levels of violence and verbal abuse associated with that, where customers were getting very frustrated by these machines and often taking it out on the staff who have got responsibility for looking after them. So that's another issue I think retailers have got to think about, is how well that they're, you know, they're staffing these systems to make sure that it doesn't increase customer frustration and annoyance.
Adrian, thank you for joining us and sharing your research.
It's been a pleasure. It's been a pleasure.
Adrian Beck is an emeritus professor in the Department of Criminology at the University of Leicester. He's an advisor to a Belgium company that researches retail theft. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with more on the mission behind an annual benefit concert.
There's a father in Madison who turned a tragedy into a cause for hope. Mike Gamal lost his son to epilepsy, then founded the organization and benefit concert, Joey's Song. As WPR's Gabby Vinnick tells us, it supports people with epilepsy.
Mike Gamal is not a rock star, but he knows how to get them to rally around a cause.
As you start out an email or a phone call with, my five-year-old son died and I need your help, most people, they can't always help, but most people will say, well, what can I do to help?
In 2010, his son Joey Gamal died, just 1 week shy of his fifth birthday. He suffered a severe and rare form of epilepsy called Dravet syndrome. Epilepsy is a chronic neurological disease that causes seizures. To Gamal, Joey was a carefree and happy kid.
He made the best of life and was always laughing and always smiling and always, he was in his own world, but he was never had a down moment. And those are the kinds of things that I think about.
Gamal was always a music fan, and so was Joey, especially when he heard a song by Sesame Street's Elmo.
He would grab everybody by their finger and make them get up and dance, and he kind of had this little boppy dance. And his word for dance was D.
As a way to work through his grief, Gamal created the nonprofit Joey's Song in honor of his son and their family's positive memories of him. The organization raises money to fund research grants and support programs for people with epilepsy. He started selling CDs but found that the events Gamal paired them with raised far more money. Gamal said there are plenty of causes to support, and he's learned to not take no from an artist personally. Yet his tenacity has helped Gamal successfully assemble an impressive lineup that would catch the eye of any 90s rock fan. Performers include members of Garbage, Soul Asylum, Belly, and Fountains of Wayne. There's also the Wisconsin Musicians Supergroup, the Know-It-All Boyfriends. All of the musicians play for free. Letters to Cleo singer Kay Hanley was one of the performers at Joey's Song this year. She says her daughter experienced seizures, but it took a long time to receive a proper diagnosis.
We had a neurologist that treated a certain kind of epilepsy, and then she developed into another kind of epilepsy, and the doctor didn't know how to treat it, and we didn't know where to go.
Finally, they found a pediatric epilepsy specialist at LA Children's Hospital.
She said, in my estimation, your treatment has been a failure. And we all burst into tears, but like, it wasn't sad tears, it was happy tears, because it was like, we finally felt like we were understood.
Hanley says her daughter, who's 23 now, has been treated and is doing well, but she says it's important to continue raising awareness. According to the Epilepsy Foundation, 1 in 26 people will get epilepsy in their lifetime. Data from the CDC shows that in Wisconsin, nearly 60,000 people have the disorder. Gamal says he wanted to start a charity dedicated to fighting epilepsy when Joey was alive. But after Joey passed, Gamal tapped into his Madison music scene connections to kickstart the organization.
The prognosis then and even today isn't really great with Dravet's. So we knew that there wasn't a lot we were going to do to make Joe's life better, even if he had survived.
but he knew he could do something to help other families.
For me, it was like, okay, let's try to change something. If we can make one family not go through what we went through our efforts, then it's worth whatever hours that we put into it.
Years later, Kamal says he considers many of the musicians involved in Joey's song his friends.
WPR's Gabby Vinnick brought us that story on Joey's Song, an organization that supports people with epilepsy. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. And find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now to a growing body of research into mind-altering drugs, especially psilocybin, the psychoactive ingredient in hallucinogenic mushrooms. We dive into UW-Madison research on these substances and the clinical trials underway. Join in at any point, calling with your questions about psychedelic drug research at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Paul Hudson is director of the UW Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. Center opened in 2021, studies potential therapeutic uses. Paul, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Kate, thank you very much for having me this morning.
So the center really getting started here, studying the effects of psilocybin on opioid use disorder. Why are researchers hopeful psilocybin can help with opioid addiction?
Well, we've seen reports from other really great institutions such as the New York University and Johns Hopkins and University of Alabama, Birmingham, that psilocybin doses, 2 to 3 of them, seem to have a really dramatic effect on alcohol use, tobacco addiction, and also even cocaine abuse. And so we've got a really strong group of investigators here in the addictive medicine, Randy Brown and Christopher Nicholas. We felt that our expertise with psilocybin from previous studies really suggested that we look at the unaddressed problem of opioid addiction with psilocybin and also methamphetamine.
What stage are you in the research with the connection to helping opioid addiction?
We have both studies open for opioid and separately for methamphetamine addiction. Both studies are fairly new in terms of being opened. And so we are beginning the process of recruiting individuals that might be appropriate for these studies.
What type of individuals would be appropriate for the opioid addiction study?
Well, we are looking for individuals who are otherwise reasonably healthy, who are abusing opioids. And the criteria are a little bit detailed, so I don't want to go into too much detail here. But but basically those who are abusing opioids, and we in the past have been looking at people who are also on stable doses of Suboxone or buprenorphine. But in this case, we can take individuals who are not yet on buprenorphine or Suboxone and put them on it. Our goal there, Kate, is to see if we can keep them on the buprenorphine maintenance therapy. Now, addiction of any sort is considered a chronic disease. And just like some people take thyroid medicine for low thyroid levels, so individuals who have opioid addiction can run a relatively normal life if they can be consistent with taking some of these maintenance therapies like Suboxone or methadone and move on with their life. Unfortunately, there are some people that still have a hard time not taking these other illicit substances like heroin that might be laced with fentanyl. And so our hope, frankly, with these studies is first to show that it's safe, that we don't make things worse. We don't expect that we will, but also perhaps that we can decrease their use of illicit drugs.
Oh, I think that's really interesting because down the road, as psychedelic therapeutics come to market that day, you're kind of seeing this as, you know, when other treatment avenues have failed in some way, that perhaps what you're working on with these types of therapies and psilocybin could be the next step?
Yes, indeed. Typically, we're going to be integrating this with some cognitive behavioral therapies, some other well-established approaches of just behavioral modification. But we hope that the psilocybin, by being a frankly a disruptor of programmed thoughts, might allow people to look beyond their current affliction and say, I don't need to do this anymore. I'm willing to go through perhaps a little bit of withdrawal just to straighten out my life. And this is what we've seen with doses of psilocybin in patients who are taking or drinking too much, smoking, and even with cocaine. So we're very hopeful.
Do scientists really know what is happening in the brain? Can you tell us what's happening when people take psilocybin?
Oh, I'd like to say that we do, but we don't. We don't know if this is just a simple pharmacologic effect with a drug going into a receptor and the psychedelic components are just basically a side effect, or if they're fundamental to the benefit of the psychedelic, that we do need to have some sort of a profound psychedelic event and experience. And frankly, how long that needs to be, because there are some drugs that we're looking at that would have a very short duration of action. And we can process, we can deal with and treat more people per day. But we don't frankly know if that's going to be as effective as several hours of being under the influence of psilocybin with a trained facilitator.
What are the challenges and barriers, you know, as a Schedule I drug, the challenges to getting psilocybin approved for treatment purposes?
Well, for any experimental drug, I have to go to the FDA and get permission to use a drug as an experimental drug. And I've done that with not only psilocybin, but for herbals, for various other previous studies. So there's a process that I have to go through to look at any experimental drug. The psilocybin adds some complexity in that I have to get permission from the state and the DEA to use psilocybin in this case for investigational use, or just to have it, period. I'll be honest with you, the FDA and the state and the DEA have not been in any way obstructive. In fact, I've had some informal conversations with individuals within the FDA and the DEA saying, we're really excited about this. We think that there's a lot of potential, just don't cut corners. And in fact, the FDA has given breakthrough drug status to psilocybin for the treatment of depression, and similarly MDMA for the treatment of PTSD.
And we're going to talk about MDMA more in a moment, but that kind of runs parallel to this storyline we're hearing out there that, you know, in this field, that after a half century, psychedelic drug research is making a big comeback now. And I'm just wondering, what has changed?
Well, that's a good question. I think that in some respects, many people of my age, I'm not one of them, who are in places of authority and regulatory control, may have had some psychedelic experience in the past and said, you know, the time may have come. But I'll credit Roland Griffiths at Johns Hopkins for really pushing things back into the highway here to get things rolling. And I really credit Johns Hopkins for taking the initiative and getting some really great clinical studies going to show that, in fact, there's a lot of great science here that supports this work.
So circling back one more time here to opioid addiction, clinical trials underway. What is the roadmap like, the timeline like?
So psilocybin is primarily being developed by two organizations, USONA Institute and Compass Pathways for the Treatment of Depression. And they are both pretty much in the same position of moving into the regulatory clinical trials. I expect that psilocybin will probably be approved by the FDA for the treatment of depression in 2025 or 26. So we're not too far away. The roadmap is that once a drug is approved for a particular indication, then prescribers can typically prescribe it for other uses, so that if it's approved for depression, a therapist prescriber could prescribe it for opioid addiction as well.
We have the head of the UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances, Paul Hudson, as we explore what scientists are investigating with the way psychedelics work on the brain, the roadmap ahead. Join our conversation with your questions about psychedelics, the future of these therapy avenues, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the scientific research of mushrooms that produce psilocybin, the chemicals with psychoactive properties, and what it means for brain science and mental health treatment in the future. Call in with your questions about this growing body of research on psychedelics, 800-642-1234. Paul Hudson leads the UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances, a professor in the UW School of Pharmacy. Paul, we heard from Mary in Bayfield, called in and says that they really want to hear you talk about how this could be used to treat methamphetamines. And Mary says this is a huge problem in rural areas, and people don't often talk about it because opioids get more attention. What can you tell us?
That is a big problem, Kate. I was mentioning how individuals who have an opioid addiction can be successfully treated with long-term buprenorphine, suboxone, and methadone treatment. There is no such maintenance therapy that allows them to go on with their normal lives with methamphetamine. So it's actually, in some respects, even a bigger problem in that regard. And we are very hopeful that the psilocybin-assisted therapy will provide these individuals with the ability to decrease the use or even stop the use of methamphetamine based on our experience of others in tobacco use and alcohol.
Your center is recruiting active meth users in order to study the effects of psilocybin, and you've noted trials with participants who are actively using drugs is uncommon. Can you talk about that? Why recruit people who are actively using meth?
Well, they're the ones that we need to treat, and you could argue that it's unethical if we're looking for individuals who are abusing the drugs to find people who are not using it and then start them on that path. One of the major components of these first studies that we're doing with opioids and with methamphetamine is first to see if it's safe, if we make things worse, but also if we can do this, if these individuals who have so many things going on with their lives, including the addiction, can actually participate in the studies, which are frankly a little bit complex in terms of the number of visits and the time required.
Do you do brain scans? What do you follow in the individual who's part of the clinical trial on meth?
Well, a lot of it is very simple and just asking them, how much are you using? And many people, or most people, will be honest about that, especially if they're seeking help by being in a clinical study. We do have brain scans that we do in some of our studies with MRIs to see if we can identify a change in the brain function, the brain metabolism. And in other studies, we're doing high-density electroencephalograms with Dr. Matthew Banks and Giulio Tononi. We have some really great facilities here to try to figure out how the circuitry in the brain might be modified. If I could, there's some evidence that these psychedelics and other drugs may actually change the wiring of the brain a little bit to allow it to, in a sense, start new synapses and make new connections. So we're hoping that we can identify some improvement through some of these scans.
Talking about new research into the effects of hallucinogenic drugs on disorders like addiction with Paul Hudson, director of the UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Jeff is joining us from Appleton. Jeff, hi.
Hi there. My question for the guest, what are your thoughts on the recreational use of psilocybin? Looking at this kind of as a parallel to marijuana, there are medical uses for marijuana, but the medical uses have kind of been hijacked and used as an end around to get to legalized recreational. So what are your thoughts on this possibly being hijacked as a way to get psilocybin as a legalized recreational drug?
Jeff, thank you for the call. Paul?
Great question. There's a lot of pressure, of course, to make it recreational. And I think a lot of that pressure is both from the users that would like to use it, but also from companies that would like to make a dollar off of it. Like alcohol or marijuana, I would basically say that if someone is going to use psilocybin or any other psychedelic, that they should not drive or do anything hazardous with it, because there are, you know, it's just unsafe. Most of the accidents, most of the injuries, most of the deaths associated with use of psychedelics occur from injuries, accidents that occur under the influence. Also, one should not expect that recreational use of psychedelics will be therapeutic. We have a program of screening individuals and preparing them for the dose and attending them in interacting them with the dose, whether it's the psilocybin or the MDMA. And we feel that this is fundamental to the therapeutic benefit, that just taking it isn't necessarily going to make people better. It may give them a psychedelic experience that might be cool, and in some cases it may help. But in terms of expecting a therapeutic benefit, we're not yet convinced that recreational use is going to have that.
I want to turn now to MDMA. The center published a study about the effects of MDMA, street name ecstasy, on people who have severe post-traumatic stress disorder and substance use disorder. What did you learn there?
Well, we were part of a multi-site study that is basically a regulatory event where the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Sciences, MAPS, has gone to the trouble of trying to develop a program to bring MDMA to the FDA for approval. The phase three studies, as we call them, we're participating in two, show that there's at least a twofold, if not a threefold, increase in the number of individuals with PTSD who no longer fit the diagnosis, that are basically in remission, which is enormously effective or important, because most of these individuals had an average of 14 years of PTSD that was refractory to other treatment.
I wonder, you know, how do you balance the risk versus the reward here? I'm not sure another way to put it, but, there are going to be side effects. And what do you think about the balance with psychedelics and who would benefit versus the side effects that could happen?
Side effects of psilocybin are really fairly mild, limited to some elevation in blood pressure, heart rate. We sometimes see a headache that we can treat with some Tylenol. The MDMA, a little bit more of a concern. Elevated blood pressure, possibly fevers. And so there's more of a concern with that. There's also a concern with MDMA as being, in some cases, a drug that is subsequently abused or has led to addictions. However, in the studies that we've been in, that we participated in, there is no evidence of ongoing abuse of the methamphetamine once they were in the study. So it doesn't, this being in these studies and these controlled environments does not seem to lead to later abuse.
That's very promising.
Yeah, it's very promising. And psilocybin and LSD, both psychedelics, there's no evidence in animal studies or human studies that they are addictive, that taking it leads to subsequent use.
Paul, thank you for joining us.
Kate, it's been a pleasure. I hope to talk with you again soon.
Take care. Paul Hudson is director of the UW-Madison Transdisciplinary Center for Research in Psychoactive Substances. The center has two clinical trials underway on the effects of psilocybin on substance abuse. You can find links to these studies on our program page at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.